you know, the one thing I would find, I joke with folks that I have a number of folks who spend a lot of time in the principal's office, right? So they may be bankers, but they're the ones that get frustrated with the way things sort of are traditionally done and know that there's a better way. We actually just give them permission and the tools to think differently and come up with some creative things that in the end keep us out of the principal's office, to use that analogy, right? And that's, I think, a little bit different way to think about it.
Barefoot Innovation starts right now. Welcome to Barefoot Innovation and my conversation with one of the most interesting bankers I know, Dominic Venturo of U.S. Bank. Visiting Dominic in his office in downtown Minneapolis is a little bit like walking onto a James Bond movie set during the Q gadget briefing scenes. There's a wonderful wow factor in encountering these really fascinating new technologies in banking that are the things he's working on day to day. The title CIO used to stand for Chief Information Officer and obviously still does, but increasingly today the I in CIO is standing for a different word, which is innovation. Dominic is the Chief Innovation Officer of US Bank, and in that role is reflecting a growing trend of banks naming leaders who are spearheading their work in innovative technology. At U.S. Bank, they actually took this step a long time ago. As we learned in our episode 12 with their CEO, Richard Davis, U.S. Bank is the country's fifth largest, and it has a big focus on innovation that caused them to put Dominic into this role 8 years ago. I love the fact that he was such an early user of Twitter, for example, and he was able to get the very cool handle @innovator, spelled with an 8, which I'm sure everyone is envious of today. I really recommend following him on Twitter. He's fantastic. I always enjoy hearing the backgrounds of our podcast guests and noticing the mix between people who do and don't have financial backgrounds. In Dominic's case, he's a career banker, 16 years at US Bank and 26 years overall in financial services. So he talked with me about how to build an innovation team that mixes together financial skills and also the tech and science skills that are needed. He's got 25 people working on his team. In this conversation, he talks about how to make an innovation team highly productive. He talks about the art of making innovation happen inside a big company, which is always a challenge. There's a lot of conventional advice about that, including the need to sort of wall off the innovators and let them do their thing. Dominic emphasizes that this has to be a full-time job, that it's sort of a self-delusion to think that you're going to put part-time people into it and that somehow they're going to stay on top of today's technology trends by catching up on their reading when they go home at night. At the same time, though, he talks a lot about how to stay practical. He says innovation loves constraints. And he talks about finding problems that need solutions as opposed to sort of blue sky solutions in search of problems. And he talks about that being one of the secrets to getting innovation actually adopted in the bank, even if it's going to take some work. Another key that he focuses on is creating very non-bank types of success metrics for innovation, recognizing that these are efforts that are going to require a lot of experiments that are ultimately going to fail in a type of company that is attempting to get failure rates down nearly to zero in every other thing that they're doing. Our conversation covered a wide range of issues. He talks about examples of their innovation success stories. He talks about downside risks for consumers. He talks about his thinking on regulation and how it impacts innovation, and he has advice on how to keep up with technology change. Be sure to go to our show notes for those ideas. And again, be sure to follow him on Twitter. He's got tremendous insight and also a fantastic sense of humor. It often happens in our podcasts that when we finish and turn off the microphone, We then end up continuing to talk. And with Dominic, we went on to cover a whole lot more interesting things that unfortunately I did not get recorded. We talked about the Internet of Things, and he demonstrated some amazing new technologies to me. Again, it was kind of like Q and James Bond. And then just as we were wrapping up, he noticed that I had what was at the time my brand new iPhone 6S, which I feel pretty cool about saying I had before he had one. And so he showed me how to use the live photo tool, which he compared to watching a Harry Potter movie where the portraits are seemingly alive and moving. And so we have a little bonus at the end of this where he was explaining to me how to put that tool to use. So keep listening at the end for a little snippet of that. It's a fascinating conversation for people interested in how to figure out how to bring innovation into a bank in particular. This is probably the most rich conversation we've had yet, and I invite you to enjoy my conversation with Dominic Venturo. I am delighted to say that my guest today is Dominic Venturo, Executive Vice President and Chief Innovation Officer of U.S. Bank. Dominic, welcome.
Thank you very much, Joanne. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
I'm so glad you can be with me today. I find that sometimes in this series I'm circling back to the same organizations. We did a couple with BBVA and a lot that have been orbiting around CFSI. And in this case, I had the very enjoyable opportunity to talk with Richard Davis, your CEO, a little while back. And my travels have brought me to Minneapolis today, and I have really been wanting to sit down with you. So I'm really thrilled to be able to get both the CEO perspective and the perspective of the innovation leader in the bank.
Yeah, well, welcome back to Minneapolis. The weather is reasonably nice for this time of year, a little warmer than usual, so that's probably nice.
Good to know. I'm not complaining.
It's going to snow this weekend,
nippy.
Though. So,
oh, is it? I'll be gone.
At least in southern Wisconsin. So, in any case, I had a chance to listen to the interview that you did with Richard, so I've got a little bit of background on that.
Super.
And happy to chat with you.
Good. Well, I'm so glad to be doing this. So our podcasts are, did I already say this, searching for better ideas for financial consumers. And I have enjoyed following what you do. I'm going to come back a little bit more to asking you about how you curate the information that you share with others. But for starters, I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit just about your personal background. I think our listeners probably all know U.S. Bank, but maybe a few words about that. And then I want to, after that, turn to talking about your role.
Sure. So I'll start at a high level about the bank, right? So around 67,000 employees, fifth largest bank in the United States. We're predominantly a retail bank in 25 states, and then we're multinational in other parts of our business, whether it's trust or payments. I have the opportunity to lead the innovation group for the bank, and in the innovation group, we are focused on not all new ideas, right? So a lot of folks hear about innovation, and they think that means all new ideas come out of the innovation shop, and that really isn't what we do. What we do is we look at emerging markets and technologies. Mm-hmm. We look at human and consumer trends, like how are people behaving differently, how are they doing jobs differently, and we try to figure out where those are going to converge and how our business needs to change in order to allow our customers to do business with us easier, make things easier, simpler, faster, in a number of different ways. We started in the payments business. Mm-hmm. We've expanded our work beyond the payments business to the rest of the bank, and we're looking at everything from how employees may collaborate, how we might work with customers, the way we modify products and services, et cetera. So we have a unique position in that we're able to take a long view. We don't run a core business out of the innovation shop, which means mm-hmm. we're able to sort of look, we say, 3 to 5 years into the future and be able to anticipate how things are going to change mm-hmm. and try to help the bank make decisions around things like technology infrastructure or other supporting changes that will allow us to be there when the market evolves to the right you know, place and time. So I know that's a lot, but that's part of what we're focused on. Mm-hmm. I'm actually a career banker, which surprises a lot of people when mm-hmm. they hear that, because very often we see companies bring innovators in from the outside to get fresh thinking or think about things differently.
Right.
I've got a lot of folks on my team who are either career bankers or long-term bankers, and what's interesting about that is they know a lot about where things don't work well, and they've had direct experience with customers about things that either bug them or drive them crazy or could work better, mm-hmm. that you don't necessarily need an outsider to identify those. And mm-hmm. so we've got a number of folks with really great, deep experience that help us solve really interesting problems.
Hmm, that's great. I have found in my conversations that when I'm talking with people who are really on the innovation side of things, it's really striking that a group of them are definitely not bankers. Some of them are almost anti-bankers. They innovated because they didn't like what their bank was doing. And then there's another group that are bankers but are completely immersed in how do we think about doing things better and differently. And I think the combination is probably going to eventually get us toward the right kinds of answers.
I think it can. I think, you know, the one thing I would find, I joke with folks that I have a number of folks who spend a lot of time in the principal's office, right? So they may be bankers, but they're the ones that get frustrated with the way things sort of are traditionally done and know that there's a better way. We actually just give them permission and the tools to think differently and come up with some creative things that in the end keep us out of the principal's office, to use that analogy, right? And that's, I think, a little bit different way to think about it.
So actually, let's go to that. What are your insights on how you accomplish innovation in a great big bank? You know, that is a mystery that a lot of people scratch their heads over and just can't picture. What are the do's and don'ts?
Well, so I think one of the biggest things is to have folks who are dedicated to the practice. So calling this somebody's, you know, second job or the job that they're going to do in addition to their day job is probably a mistake. I mean, we have dedicated folks. It's the only thing that they do. And we have found that in order to be able to be on top of what's happening, not only in our industry, but all the adjacent industries, mm-hmm. you really have to do this full time. And so probably the number one don't is don't make this a side job of some other executive who has a pretty busy day job to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other piece is to empower individuals to build a framework to be able to test and learn, to try things without breaking the bank, right, without putting the bank at risk, but to be able to experiment in a way that if it fails, it's not a high-risk environment. You know, bankers are really good at working in what we call high nine success rates, right? Whether it's credit risk or whether it's system performance, mm-hmm. everything is sort of high nines,
yeah.
which means you have a very low tolerance for risk. It's sort of the culture. So when you come along and say, well, we're going to work on ideas that might fail more than 50% of the time, that's a whole different paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to give people permission, then you have to help them with the right tools, and then when they fail, you have to celebrate that failure, the attempt, the trying, just as much as you do a success.
Mm-hmm.
That all changes the culture over time.
And where did this come from? I was very impressed by the fact that you've had this role for about a decade, right?
That's eight years.
Eight years, which I could be wrong, but I don't remember running into chief innovation officers at banks 8 years ago.
No.
Was this somebody's brilliant insight, or did you propose it? How did it get started?
I did not propose it. So within the payments organization at the time, we were starting to see in the non-bank competitor space innovation shops setting up. And in the payment space, as you know, Joanne has been hotly competitive, right? Especially with non-banks, non-financial institutions
right.
around the fringe.
Definitely the front edge.
Exactly. And so for us, it was a very natural extension to say, you know, we already had a leading payments business. We were already doing a lot of things in those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have a group that had the freedom to operate out of the current year sort of operating budget.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a group that could think longer term about things that might have a longer tail in terms of return, and that put us at a bit of a disadvantage to some of the non-bank competitors and others that were receiving investment with a little more patience associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So at the time, the retail payments business decided to create the experiment, which was an innovation shop. It would be compartmentalized, and we would basically innovate the innovation shop, and if it's successful, expand it.
Yeah.
And as we've proved out that track record, we've expanded and are now doing it more broadly.
Hmm. Wow, great. How many people are on your team?
We have 25 in the organization, including myself.
And you said a lot of them are bankers. Could you describe a little bit about either the skill sets or the way you organize it? What are the component parts?
Oh boy, so so that's a little bit tricky. So folks who have really deep domain expertise in payments, for example, mm-hmm. so working on enterprise class co-brand relationships or you know that type of the business.
Mm-hmm.
We have folks who have come out of the corporate payments business who have worked on the B2B side, small business, large corporate,
mm-hmm.
Have spent time in treasury management, commercial banking. We have folks who have had time in risk management. And then we have folks who have not historically been bankers, but have worked in those other businesses around the edge, right, from the innovation side.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have been some of the external, you know, some of the external hires that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And I have everything from multiple PhD'd folks to folks that started out working in banking and have sort of advanced mm-hmm. their career from day one there. So it's quite a range.
And can you describe how you interact with the business units? Do you go to them and say, we have a great idea, or do they come to you and say, we have a problem and we hope you'll work on it? And are you side by side some of the time, even though you're in your separate world a lot of the time? Or
yeah, so we have a number of different models that we use. So organizationally, we have a group of folks we call the Innovation Leadership Group. So there are senior leaders that are representatives of all the major lines of business within the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And then that group then provides input to our team about what problems do they have to solve, where are their interesting opportunities, where do they see different markets or different parts of the business changing. That helps us source new information. We collaborate on new ideas within that sort of a framework. We may also have a brand new net idea that will show up, but my group isn't really so much about, I have a new idea, let's go find a home for it.
Mm-hmm.
We're more about identifying interesting problems to solve,
mm-hmm.
and then solving those.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we found is that a solution to a problem is much more likely to be successful than something we thought was just a good idea. And we do have business groups. Matter of fact, I had a conversation this morning with someone who literally called and said, I have this business problem. Can your group help me understand it better and see if we can come up with some options?
Are most of the solutions that you work on, if that's the right word, customer facing? That is, are you solving a problem the customer has, or is a lot of it solving problems that are internal to the bank, getting the work done?
Most of what we have done has been around end customer.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot of primary research within our group. Everything from ethnographic, working with ethnographers. We don't have them on staff, but we work with ethnographers to mm-hmm. look at certain segments or markets or opportunities and understand problems better. So that would mm-hmm. be sort of one thing that we do. The other piece that we do is a lot of primary customer engagement from a research perspective,
mm-hmm.
which can take, you know, many, many different forms, but we try to be a really active listening post.
Mm-hmm.
And because we started out in the retail payments part of the bank, most of everything we did for the first few years was very retail consumer oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we expanded our focus, we began doing other things. But still, I would say on balance, the majority is retail consumer. Part of that reflects the composition of the bank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the retail bank itself is a big chunk of the bank in total.
Yeah. And do you go so far as to put out an MVP, a minimum viable product type of solution with the customer and then iterate with them?
Right? Yeah, so we follow, you know, sort of a hybrid between like lean startup methodology
mm-hmm.
and more traditional innovation, right? So within our group, we have some self-contained prototyping capabilities. We have the ability to stand up things that are enough to get feedback on. Mm-hmm. And then we have a number of different ways we can go get feedback, some more formal than others. When we do prototypes, or when we move from prototype to pilot, mm-hmm. which is where we have a functional product, then we will build those or build those in conjunction with others, partners, to be able to get them in the hands of customers. But those are usually done in a way that we have a defined beginning and an end. So we intend to complete the experiment, take all that input, and then use it to determine what our path forward is or not for commercialization. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think sometimes in the industry you see things called a pilot, but what they really are is a pre-commercial launch. So mm-hmm. it's, you know, once it's out in the market, it's out in the market. It's never really sort of shut down. Ours right. sort of have a beginning and an end, and then they go into the commercialization cycle and maybe in maybe a different way.
Do you find that doing that testing work is constrained by regulatory rules? Are there times you wish you could test something, but it would be crossing the line with the current regulations, or is it a pretty comfortable space? Because I get that feedback a lot from people yeah. that they wish they could experiment more, but they're feeling like they have to stay inside a box.
Yeah, I mean, I think there, well, first of all, there are some valid constraints that exist. I mean, we work closely with the OCC, mm-hmm. our primary regulator, right? And so we have conversation with them about things that we're doing well before we do them mm-hmm. to understand where there may be concerns or not. And so this may be part of just an approach that, mm-hmm. that I think we actually have pretty good ability to operate, and we'll get feedback really early on about things that we should think about or consider. Mm-hmm. However, there are some spaces that will start to get off limits pretty rapidly, right? When you're dealing in spaces of privacy, or if you're dealing in mm-hmm. other spaces where you're thinking about wanting to test security or other technology, there are some spaces where you can say, well, gee, I wish I didn't have those constraints. But mm-hmm. the reality is, if you really dig into them, they're there for a reason. So you need to find a way to be able to operate within them appropriately.
There seems to be a growing amount of talk about whether there's more potential to create regulatory sandboxes where there could right. be like set safe rules within which banks and financial companies could experiment and make sure that the consumer understood that there was an experiment, make sure the consumer would be made whole if anything went wrong and that kind of thing. Does that make sense to you?
It could make sense, Joanne. So here's one of the challenges. So like, I'll give you an example. So we've been working for a while on how to think about identity in the digital space differently. Mm-hmm. And recently we went out and talked about some work that we've been doing in the digital identity space, federated identity, under the NSTIC framework, so federal government, looking at right national standards for trusted identities in cyberspace mm-hmm. and how all that yeah. would work. It's great. To the point that you get to, I want to do a pilot, and then you have an identity party, a bank, and you have a relying party, not the bank, and the relying party is going to use a platform to be able to decide, right, you are you and you can have access.
Right.
So what happens if something goes wrong? So the legal framework and the regulatory framework doesn't yet account for that space.
Yeah, yeah.
And that then is an example of where you have to say, well, we're going to try it, but before we could commercialize it, we have to get the industry caught up. Mm-hmm. So having the ability to take partners in the ecosystem, like the folks that are working on NIST, and maybe I'm making this up, right, but the OCC and other regulators, and mm-hmm. say, okay, let's come up with a framework where we can operate and pilot these and understand how that's going to work mm-hmm. would be helpful. Mm-hmm. I think having just a sandbox is only useful if somebody has sort of confined what you can and can't do in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
I'm excited that the regulators are, I think they're actively embracing the search for how to get better at bringing innovation into the, bringing in the good innovation while keeping out the bad impacts. As we're recording this, the OCC has created a task force on this. The Fed has a conference coming up on it. The CFPB has had its Catalyst program all along. I just got back yesterday from a meeting in the UK and met with the Financial Conduct Authority, and they have their innovation hub project going on. And so there's a lot of movement by the regulators to try to figure out how to become good at this.
I think there
it's not easy.
It isn't easy, and there is a lot of movement, and I think that's good. I think, you know, the other side of that space is looking at the periphery. So you have the non-bank players who sometimes are completely outside of the oversight. And if you're going to use the analogy, you would say, well, how does that thing I see on TV that looks like a medical device not be regulated by the FDA? You know, just an example.
Right,
and the FDA would say, well, we don't regulate non-medical devices, and we only pay attention to them if they appear to present a risk to consumers. So if you take that sort of approach to financial services, the potential issue is those things can become big and have negative consequences for consumers before they become aware of them. And so having a mechanism to be able to, you know, have those move into the ecosystem more rapidly and be able to have some consistent level of being able to deal with them, I think makes a lot of sense, because many times those entities have connections to what I'll call the on-ramps and off-ramps of banking, whether it's through ACH or whether it's through banking relationships or through other chartered entities, right? And so you have the perception that they look like a bank product even though they aren't.
Right.
So I think that's still a gap.
So let me, that's really interesting. Let me make sure I heard what you just said. The point I think that you made was that we know that we've got a highly regulated space and a less regulated space. The CFPB is leveling that playing field to some extent. But you're saying that if we could get good at allowing the innovations in the less regulated space to enter into the mainstream.
Under the right restriction and oversight, I think you could actually accelerate the things that provide real value, and you could identify the things that are maybe negative more rapidly.
I've never heard anyone say that before. That's really interesting. Can you give examples of some innovations that you folks have shepherded along and are now part of the mainstream of the bank?
Sure. So so some of the most recent stuff that we have done has been in the mobile payment space in terms of what's come to market. So we're now one of the few financial institutions in the U.S. that's active in Samsung Pay, Android Pay, and Apple Pay, sort of all at the same time. And a lot of that came out of early work that our group did with our payments business and the ecosystem around tokenization standards, looking at the future architecture of how that's going to play out, and then being able to adopt those new opportunities sort of as they come up, as opposed to, you know, having these really long build cycles that banks are sort of more notorious for. So that would be a pretty recent example of work that we've been doing. More specifically in terms of things we've independently done, because that obviously took, you know, a whole community to be able to advance a new standard and new technology and really important partners to make it work. When I look at work that we've done in some of the mobile enablement spaces and how to leverage the power and capability of those mobile devices to help our customers do business with us differently, you know, we're able to do marketing, apply for, open a credit card, for instance, on a mobile device, which you might say, who would ever want to do that? And actually, when we did when we did research, we heard folks weren't terribly interested, or at least they said they weren't terribly interested. But what's interesting is when provided with the opportunity, we find they're actually using it. And one of the reasons they're using it is because of the increased privacy concerns. So now, instead of putting my personal information on a piece of paper and handing it to somebody, sometimes in a store, right? And you might worry about the data security and privacy of what's going on with that information. Being able to do it on my own device, on my own time, and then have that decision rendered has actually turned out to be really attractive. And at the time, we were the only bank that was able to do that, and I think we're one of the only ones that's still doing it sort of end to end.
Wow, that's interesting. I remember seeing some of the early feedback on Apple Pay being that one of the top motivators people had was that they recognized that it had another security layer in it.
Right.
And people feel, people are motivated by that.
Right. And that it isn't your primary card.
Right.
Our early experiments with mobile payments, your primary card was the same one that went on the mobile device. And the very first question we got over and over again is, what happens when I lose my phone?
Yeah.
Apparently people lose their phones a lot. I've never lost one, but apparently it happens because it's a common question. So, you know, you have to sort of think that through.
Yeah. Are you an optimist about mobile payments making a pretty rapid evolution and transformational change, or do you think it's going to take a lot of time?
I'm an optimist that thinks it will take time. So here's why. I believe in the technology, and I think we're actually adding value, right? So being able to have domain-specific security is a big deal. And that will show up in other, you know, domains or channels or whatever words you want to use. So I actually think that's a big deal. But more importantly, as the merchant community moves into EMV and adopts hardware and new technology and enables contactless, for example, payments to happen, the transactions for a contactless mobile transaction are fast and easy and quick. And it used to be a common thing for people to say, well, the old card swipe thing worked just fine.
Yeah.
But when you have to put an EMV card in a chip reader and go through the chip authentication and the process, even though it only adds, you know, like 1-point-something seconds, studies have been done, not very much, the perception is that that's more time-consuming than sort of a tap-and-go, and which is, I think, interesting, and we'll see how it plays out. But I think the sleeper, if you will, in that technology is actually the in-app purchases and the ability to simplify commerce on the mobile device. Whether and as some of the mobile devices are getting bigger, people are doing more primary shopping right on them. And so being able to take what used to be a pretty complex interaction and get it all the way down to a simple pay button or a fingerprint read or a whatever, I think will be a big deal over time.
I do too. It's sort of an Uberization of payments.
Right.
In general.
Well, I mean, to get a little farther thinking, right? Why would you focus so much on the physical point of sale interaction when I literally could just fill up the bag and walk out of the store, and when I walk out, I pay, and that's technically feasible. We don't see anybody doing it yet, but it's technically feasible.
What else would you point to that you think are the most promising innovations in the pipeline, on the horizon, or wherever, for the consumer, the biggest things that are going to make consumers' lives better?
I think we're seeing some really interesting stuff. So we haven't talked a lot about the details of this, so I'm going to abstract it a little bit. But we're doing some really interesting work in how we can help our customers who are doing business with us conduct their business more seamlessly. So we've been doing work in the remote location and offer space, which we have talked about, where we're doing mobile apps and we're able to deliver meaningful offers in a real-time way for local merchants, for things that somebody is interested in, and extending that kind of capability out to then be able to make it simpler to manage things from a security and I know you are you and you're the one doing business. I think there's some real opportunities there because, as I know you know, because you travel a lot and travel internationally, one of the big challenges is knowing as an institution where your card's going to show up being used around the world.
And then
knowing, is it actually Joanne who's doing the transaction? And so there are some technologies at play that can help make that much more seamless for customers. And hopefully it will appear invisible. But it'll just work, and that'll be an awesome experience.
Yeah, I did have a card rejected while I was in London the other day, so that resonates with me. What do you think about the inclusiveness goal? Do you think that we've got some innovations underway that are going to be able to reach more consumers with mainstream financial services?
Yeah, I think, well, so first of all, important topic. I think as we look at the work that we've been doing in the prepaid space, with general purpose reloadable and other products, we've learned a lot. We still have room to go ourselves and as an industry in terms of being able to help folks migrate from one kind of a product to another. So they've historically been sort of walled off individual silos at most of the big banks in the country.
Right.
And so if I'm a consumer and I have product A and I use it for a year or two and I'm responsible and everything else, and now all of a sudden I'd like to have, you know, move from a general purpose reloadable to a DDA, for example,
right.
and bill pay,
right.
it's as if I start all over again.
Right, because in most banks, those are totally different
Completely
channels.
Different. And the data doesn't cross, and there are just a whole bunch of reasons for that. But that, I think, is a real opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we look at the advancements of what's happening with the tools we use to let our customers engage with us. So, if, for instance, if you just look at our mobile banking app, you know, you have the ability to do banking, you have the ability to do pay a person, you have the ability to do photo bill pay, you can do balance transfer, you can do all these things. Well, all those things include a whole bunch of really rich data that all of that behavior data ultimately starts to become information that you can use to help manage risk and decide about things like, you know, granting credit and graduation programs, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there, and that the opportunity is more real than it had been even only 5 years ago, because the ability to get at the performance data is greatly improved from where it used to be.
Because of the technology.
Because of the bridging technology that allows you to get it from point A to point B.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, banks traditionally have been pretty product-centric and or channel-centric.
Right.
And as you say, if you can move to being consumer-centric, pardon me, you start to open up on a whole lot of new kinds of opportunities for consumers.
I believe so too, and I think at the same time you still have to have that product domain expertise because of the risk involved. So, you know, you kind of have to have both, and being too biased in one way or the other tends to not allow for the opportunity to cross-pollinate.
Yeah. What would you point to as emerging risks for consumers? It seems to me the nature of innovation is that it brings good and bad things that are sort of mixed together, usually. So I think there's a need to be, for the regulators and the industry, to be thinking, and the consumer, kind of understanding emerging downside risk at the same time they're enjoying all these great new things.
Yeah, so, you know, from a cybersecurity perspective and a privacy perspective, we have things that are at odds with each other. We have a sharing society that has become increasingly digitally social, that is publishing amazing amounts of information out into the ether, if you will. And that is making it easier for the criminal element to do the work that they do.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I would love to think that somehow it could be harder. But the reality is we're making it, you know, we as a society are making it easier, which is making it harder for the banks to do their business around, you know, everything from KYC and making sure that the account is actually you, and once we have it, making sure that it hasn't been compromised. So there's the whole cybersecurity side of keeping the bank safe.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really just talking about, you know, the information sharing of data in that sort of public domain that makes it challenging. The other part of it is that as technology has improved, it's become easier for criminals to do what they do remotely,
mm-hmm.
which makes it harder for us to catch them, right,
right.
as an industry.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that that's necessarily the biggest risk, but in mass, it appears to sort of float to the, you know, it appears to sort of float to the top as we work to, as you secure out payment security and card numbers, then other things like personal data become the next likely target.
And there are some technology solutions in sort of a cat and mouse contest, I guess, with the bad guys for some of these things, maybe.
Oh, sure. I mean, we see new things all the time where folks are working in those spaces. So there are. But it is the never-ending chase.
As I listen to you talk, one of the questions that comes to my mind is, this may seem like a funny one, do your colleagues all understand what you're talking about. Do you find that you get into like a translation or education need with some of the traditional bankers, or people, or is everybody kind of on the same page?
Well,
because I can tell you, we have some listeners who probably are only partially following some of what you're saying.
Yeah, that's probably that's a fair point.
Which is good. I mean, I'm not.
I think the honest answer is there are plenty of folks who have a general understanding of what our mission is and what, or you know, and what we do.
Mm-hmm.
That part's easy. Where it gets more complicated is when you say, well, we're focused on emerging technologies. Well, what do you mean by that? What kind of technologies? And how do you pay attention to that? And why do you care what a cell phone does versus, right, those other things? So it is very easy to rapidly end up in a more technical discussion. Mm-hmm. Part of what we have to do is, you know, bring it back to the business level to explain, you know, how it might matter. But it is a challenge. I think from a presentation perspective, when we're talking internally, mm-hmm. we try to customize to the audience. So if we're working with risk professionals and the technology organization, we're going to have a very different dialogue than if we're talking mm-hmm. to a business manager who maybe is less focused on some of the technical details.
Do you think that banks need to develop innovation cultures, and do you think you've been successful in doing that here?
Well, I think in order for innovation to work, your culture needs to support it. So it would be, you know, the question is which came first,
mm-hmm.
right? So does the culture support the entrepreneurial spirit, and does it support the ability to take balanced risks? And sometimes you have to prove your way into it,
mm-hmm.
right? So I don't know that I would have expected us to create an innovation shop 8 years ago. But when the idea came up and we had the opportunity to talk about how it might work, one of the things we said was we need to have the ability and the freedom to try things and potentially fail,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, in and of itself a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we didn't create the culture that supported that. The culture already said it was going to support that.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we proved it out, it began to embrace it more broadly.
Mm-hmm.
So they go together. But I got to tell you, I've talked to a number of folks who work in other financial institutions around the country where my advice to them has been, you know, probably not a good idea to try to do this unless you can get, you know, your super senior leadership on board. Because unless you have the executive leadership reinforcing the importance, it's, you're really pushing things uphill and it's tough to get a lot done.
Exactly. I think there's a wave rolling through the industry as people are starting to move there, but most people probably are not there yet. So how do you measure your success?
Great question. We're still figuring that out, believe it or not. I mean, one of the things we do is we look at how many projects are we advancing? What does that portfolio look like? And on balance, how many are being commercialized versus failing?
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny because if you said, well, is the goal to have more succeed?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not. Maybe the goal is to have more throughput in total or have a bigger portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
We're running somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% of what we term a pilot
mm-hmm.
then ultimately gets into some form of commercialization.
Mm-hmm.
You could argue that's a good metric, or you could argue that you're not taking enough risk and you should, you know, you should potentially fail more.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of that is whether or not you are able to test and learn cost effectively. So if it costs a mountain of money to do a pilot, then your success rate needs to go up.
Mm-hmm.
If you can do it cost effectively, then it can go down. So we have to kind of look at the whole thing. So we really look at the portfolio of activity, the success rate, and sort of look at how much we're spending to learn what we learn,
mm-hmm.
And try to keep that moving in a downward direction instead of, you know, upward.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be sort of the primary lenses for which we apply.
Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of bank senior managers who listen. What would be your advice to them if they were interested in... I think a lot of banks are taking what they do and trying to use technology to enable it. So they're trying to have a mobile app or improve their website or whatever. but if they wanted to try to step onto this pathway toward transformation and, again, recognizing that the industry is facing real disruption and that people are going to have to get good at changing, what steps would you suggest they take?
Wow. So a longer answer than what we have time for, probably. But the short version is where I began. Mm-hmm. When I said that making innovation somebody's second job is probably not a way to start. Mm-hmm. And so having a dedicated focus on it, I think, is important. Now, maybe I'm biased because we've had that luxury, right? Mm-hmm. But I've actually seen others try doing it as a part-time job. And what happens is the day job and the current month or the current quarter or the whatever gets in the way, and pretty soon you're not focused long-term anymore and you're making decisions that are, you know, narrowly focused on sort of the current objectives. So being able to carve out some element of resource and then enabling them with actual tools and capabilities. I can tell you that there is not much more frustrating than having folks charged with being able to work on stuff but then not actually be able to get it done. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we've evolved over our 8 years and we've enabled different kinds of capabilities. And we've experimented with things that work and don't work. One of the things that doesn't work is being an influencer alone. So having somebody who is focused on innovation as a topic, whose job it is to push other business lines, for example, to go do that, mm-hmm. is probably not the best strategy, would be, you know, another piece of advice.
Hmm. So I'm going to come back in a moment to the question of sort of how you deal with the the finite time in the midst of all of this fast change. But before we do that, I have one other question, kind of on the structure of innovation. Do you have thoughts on the dilemma of how the bank charter should fit into this increasingly complicated value chain? The need for the regulators to protect the bank charter and the deposit insurance and the, you know, their concern about the rent-a-charter thing. What are the secrets to how banks should or shouldn't be partnering with others, going into business with innovators, all of
that?
Well,
I mean, I think those are really valid concerns, right? So there's a phrase, we didn't coin it, innovation loves constraints, but it actually does. So, you know, if you give folks sort of complete whiteboard, unlimited time, and you just tell them to go work on a problem, you'll get back just a bunch of stuff that's not terribly useful. Mm-hmm. But if you have tight constraints and time frames and other things, you'd be surprised what people will come up with. So I actually view that set of constraints as just the world in which we operate in, and we don't spend a lot of time saying, well, how could we change those rules so we could do something different? Mm-hmm. My point about the on-ramps earlier, mm-hmm. in this conversation was actually around how do you enable folks to get from outside the regulated entities into in a way that meets those criteria,
right.
As opposed to what happens now, which is sometimes you have little workarounds that don't get noticed until they become big enough to become problematic. Mm-hmm. And then you have to go unwind something or change something or that, mm-hmm. type of thing.
Yeah. Okay, great. So let me turn to, I follow you on Twitter, and I always tell everybody that they should. You're one of my favorite people on Twitter. Talk about how you keep up with technology change, how you help your team keep up, and do you have particular favorite resources, publications, podcasts?
Yeah. Well, do we have favorites? No. We consume a lot of content. So it's funny, when my group first started and there was just a handful of us, we would have articles and I would ask folks, you know, what did you think about the article? And they would say things like, I haven't had time to read it. I was busy last night or whatever. And I would, mm-hmm. be like, what do you mean you were busy last night? Well, I took it home. And I, you know, because reading isn't something bankers do at work. They don't study, they don't research at work unless you're a research person,
yeah.
right? And so folks sort of thought like that wasn't part of the job. And it, when it became part of the job, the world changed almost overnight, because what happens is, you know, everybody's got a little different routine. But for example, mine is, I scan Twitter as one of the first things I do in the morning. Why? Because I follow a lot of people around the world. Mm-hmm. A lot happens around the world while I'm sleeping, and I can wake up and find, you know, a lot of really interesting nuggets of information or new trends or a new idea or something that's happening. Those links almost always go to some other publication, sometimes things I've never heard of before, and I may say, oh, this looks high quality, let's add it to the list of things that we follow. So that's, you know, one person's methodology. Although, and then we have other curation sort of services that help pull us together based on topics and interests that we update on a quarterly basis to keep, you know, to keep us informed. And then, you know, other secondary research. So it's really a multi-level approach. And there's always something somebody sends me almost every day that we still miss or didn't see. And so, you know, you just got to sort of always keep your eyes open. But I think the average person in my group probably spends an hour or more looking at new stuff every day. And when you get 25 people that are doing that, it's amazing all the stuff that they find. And we share monthly in a sharing session different things that we find and, you know, is it interesting or not?
In a way, it's another angle on what you said before about people. You said we need the bank needs to dedicate people to the job, and the people in the job need to dedicate time to the learning of it, or you'll never keep up.
Yeah.
It's impossible to keep
up. I have a lot of self-learners who are always doing that. I think the other important thing for us has been businesses that we do business with, so our partners, in some cases large corporate, in some cases otherwise, we will have sort of readouts with them about what do they see in the emerging technology space and trends and things like that. And so you can learn a lot from non-banking industries that you work with, whether in, you know, they're in desktop computing or mobile devices or networks or what have you.
I think one of the reasons that I sometimes think the banking world is underestimating some of the change that's coming toward it is because so much of it's happening beyond their field of vision. You know, it's happening in the tech world and not necessarily being covered in the banking press or not thoroughly.
Exactly. I mean, we see stuff in the non-banking space, the tech world, years before it makes it into the banking space. So that feeler alone, you know, is a pretty good lens to apply.
So I'm picking your brain here for advice for people who are not as far along with this as you are. If you were going to advise people on where to start, you know, somebody who's listening who just wants to say, like, what should I read every day other than Dominic's tweets, what would you suggest?
Wow. So that's a good question, and we're so random in the pieces that we do, right? So, you know, I'll look at things like the Wall Street Journal personal tech side of things in terms of what's happening there. We'll look at, you know, what is TechCrunch talking about, or, you know, what's happening in the space with, I think they just changed their name, Quartz. So, you know, it's interesting because some of these new media companies that are popping up are covering the tech space more deeply than some of the traditional or mainstream sort of press. And so I think you're always sort of changing that out. Part of the way I learned that, though, Joanne, is because when I look at, I have a curated list of people that I follow on Twitter. So if I follow somebody on Twitter, it's generally because either A, I know them, or B, they publish interesting or link to interesting content. What I'm finding is that the sources that are coming from that stream are constantly evolving. And so then all of a sudden I'll learn of some new thing that I didn't know before. So if you find a couple of folks that you find interesting and then go look at who they follow, you can usually be led to some interesting stuff in the Twitter domain.
You want to name any names?
No.
Okay. Do you have any conferences that you think are worthwhile for people?
Wow. Worthwhile is always tough because it depends on your agenda, right? So we have folks who have gone to South by Southwest, which is surprising to some bankers about why would you go there, but they have a whole digital track, and that whole digital track is increasingly early stage tech and other emerging concepts. So it's turned out to be incredibly insightful. And very creative. And because we operate in the commerce space, right, because we have a payments business that does merchant acquiring as well as issuing, we tend to find more value in that than maybe a traditional bank that doesn't have those assets might. So that would be one. Finovate is always a good place to see, you know, mm-hmm. startups, and they've expanded their domain pretty dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say they would be pretty good. Bank Innovation has been doing sort of demo contests at their, you know, they have the Demovation program.
Mm-hmm.
I had a chance to be a judge on that last year and then go see that, and actually was super impressed with the companies that were showing up there.
Yeah.
So there may be more of the non-traditional banking or financial services mm-hmm. kinds of conferences. And then we attend industry-specific stuff, whether it's wireless yeah. industry or, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah. I always tell people to go to Finovate as a good starting point, because just being there, it's so different from a banking conference. You know, you just get something by absorbing the fact that there's a different world going on here.
Yeah, I mean, live demos and seeing things that are being launched in sort of near real time is a
yeah.
very different world than,
yeah.
you know, the polished presentations. I think you can learn a lot of technical knowledge and other things at some of the banking conferences.
I
don't
do
get
too.
Me wrong. I think they're great educational
yeah,
forums.
I do too.
But if you want to see, you know, new tech startups that are doing interesting things in the
mm-hmm.
space,
yeah.
Some of those others would be good places to go.
So I have recently gone to Harvard. I'm a senior fellow.
Right.
I'm writing a book.
Right. Congratulations.
Thank you. On innovation and regulation. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you think I should be sure to explore well as I do my research and book?
I think I would look to see how are the regulators best staying on top of the emerging trends and the new areas of opportunity. I know how we do it, and I described some of that. What I don't know is do they have dedicated folks that are working in those spaces? And we've had the chance to interact with folks from the Fed, for example, who do spend time on emerging pieces and write really good white papers and
mm-hmm.
and briefs. But then I don't know how, you know, is that a siloed sort of set of capabilities or
mm-hmm.
does it expand? So I think that would be an interesting thing to understand,
mm-hmm.
which is the landscape of, you know, trend watching
mm-hmm.
And being able to assess when things become important enough to spend time on or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you think we should?
I think we covered a lot of ground.
We have.
Yeah.
It's been fascinating talking with you. So where can people find you or your program? Is it just usbank.com, or are there other that you'd like to share?
Yep, usbank.com is the corporate website, and that's where we share different information. Sometimes we have special innovation stuff that shows up on the investor relations page
mm-hmm.
And or are part of news releases or other things, but we don't have a separate website, et cetera, dedicated to the innovation side.
And on Twitter, you are?
Personally, on Twitter, I am Innovator with an 8, so I grabbed that early, I guess.
That was impressive. I know. I noticed that. Well, I want to thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I'm so delighted that you could join me today.
Yeah, thanks very much. I've enjoyed it as well. I appreciate the time.
A quick postscript that I forgot to say is that when I arrived today, Dominic saw my iPhone 6S and taught me how to use the so-called Harry Potter photography feature.
Yeah, so I'm not sure that that's what they would call it, but the live photo and the ability to create a small animation is a really interesting thing that when I first saw it, I thought, you know, this is really going to take off in terms of folks, whether it's their Instagrams or Facebook pages or whatever, just because it adds that little bit of extra dynamic. So seeing that you had one of the new phones, we wanted to test it out. It was pretty cool to see.
It was. And seeing that I had the new phone, and I've had it since the day they issued it, and I sort of knew that it could do this, but I hadn't tried it. I had forgotten about it. So this is the benefit of talking with a person whose job is chief innovation officer And I want to thank you for that because I'm going to have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah,
and we'll put
bet.
In the show notes what we're talking about and how to do this so people can play with it. So.
Cool.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with U.S. Bank's Chief Innovation Officer, Dominic Venturo. Please come to our websites for the show notes. Again, that's www.jsbarefoot.com. And if you're enjoying listening to Barefoot Innovation, please also do click the donate button there and send in something to support the costs of the show. Also, be sure to watch for our upcoming announcement on our Regulation Innovation video series, which will be looking at all these same issues, but from the angle of advice for financial companies about innovation and regulation. And last, but definitely not least, come back next time because the next episode is going to be one of my all-time favorites that we've ever recorded, a conversation with Ethan Block of Digit. See you then.